And the sick quarters? We've none of them either, sir, rightly speaking. But sick men have cots slung right up against the forward bulkhead on the starboard side by the galley. And they are indulged in the use of the roundhouse. What is that? Well, it's not really a roundhouse, more like a little row port. Not like in a frigate of a ship of the line, but it serves. What for? I hardly know how to explain, sir, said Mowat, blushing. Necessary house. A Jakes? A privy? Just so, sir. But what do the other men do? Have they chamber pots? Oh, no, sir. Heavens above, they go up the hatch there and along to the heads. Little places on either side of the stem. Out of doors? Yes, sir. But what happens in inclement weather? They still go to the heads, sir. And they sleep 40 or 50 together down here with no windows? Well, if ever a man with the jail fever or the plague or the cholera morbus sets foot in his apartment, God help you all. Amen, sir, said Mowat, quite aghast at Stephen's immovable, convincing certainty. That is an engaging young fellow, said Stephen, walking into the cabin. Young Mowat? I'm happy to hear you say so, said Jack, who was looking worn and harried. Nothing pleasanter than good shipmates. May I offer you a wet? Our seaman's drink that we call grog. Are you acquainted with it? It goes down gratefully enough at sea. Simpkin, bring us some grog. Damn that fellow, he's slow as Beelzebub. Simpkin, light along that grog. God rot the flaming son of a bitch. Ah, there you are. I needed that, he said, putting down his glass. Such a tedious damn morning. Each watch has to have just the same proportions of skilled hands in the various stations and so on. Endless discussion. And, said he, hitching himself a little closer to Stephen's ear, I blundered into one of those unhappy gaffes. I picked up the list and read off Flaherty, Lynch, Sullivan, Michael Kelly, Joseph Kelly, Sheridan and Aloysius Burke, those chaps that took the bounty in Liverpool, and I said, more of these damned Irish papists. At this rate, half the starboard watch will be made up of them, and we shall not be able to get by for beads. Meaning it pleasantly, you know. But then I noticed a damn frigid kind of a chill, and I said to myself, why, Jack, you damn fool, Dylan's from Ireland, and he takes it as a national reflection. Whereas I hadn't meant anything so illiberal as a national reflection, of course, only that I hated papists. So I tried to put it right by a few well-turned flings against the Pope, but perhaps they were not as clever as I thought, for they didn't seem to answer. And do you hate papists so? Asked Stephen. Oh, yes, and I hate paperwork. But the papists are a very wicked crew too, you know, with confession and all that, said Jack. And they tried to blow up Parliament. Lord, how we used to keep up the 5th of November. One of my very best friends, you wouldn't believe how kind, was so upset when her mother married one that she took to mathematics and Hebrew directly. Aleph, Beth, though she was the prettiest girl for miles around, taught me navigation. Splendid headpiece, bless her. She told me quantities of things about the papists. I forget it all now, but they are certainly a very wicked crew. There's no trusting them. Look at the rebellion they've just had. But, my dear sir, the United Irishmen were primarily Protestants. Their leaders were Protestants. Wolfe Tone and Appertandy were Protestants. The Emmets, the O'Connors, Simon Butler, Hamilton Rowan, Lord Edward Fitzgerald were Protestants. And the whole idea of the club was to unite Protestant and Catholic and Presbyterian Irishmen. The Protestants, it was, who took the initiative. Oh? Well, I don't know much about it, as you see. I thought it was the Papists. I was on the West Indies station at the time, but after a great deal of this damn paperwork, I'm quite ready to hate Papists and Protestants too, and Anabaptists and Methodists and Jews. No, I don't give a damn. But what really vexes me is that I should have got across Dylan's hawse like that. As I was saying, there's nothing pleasanter than good shipmates. He has a sad time of it, doing a first lieutenant's duty and keeping a watch. New ship. New ship's company, new captain, and I particularly wish to ease him in. Without there's a good understanding between the officers, a ship cannot be happy, and a happy ship is your only good fighting ship. You should hear Nelson on that point. And I do assure you it's profoundly true. He'll be dining with us, and I should take it very kindly if you would, as it were... Ah, Mr. Dillon, come and join us in a glass of grog. Partly for professional reasons, and partly because of an entirely natural absence, Stephen had long ago assumed the privilege of silence at table. And now, from the shelter of this silence, he watched James Dillon with particular attention. It was the same small head held high, the same dark red hair, of course, and green eyes, the same fine skin and bad teeth. More were decaying now. The same very well-bred air. And although he was slim and of no more than the average height, he seemed to take up as much room as the 14-stone Jack Aubrey. The main difference was that the look of being just about to laugh, or of having discovered a private joke, had quite vanished. Wiped out, no trace of it. A typically grave, humourless Irish countenance now. His behaviour was reserved, but perfectly attentive and civil. Not the least appearance of sullen resentment. They ate an acceptable turbot, acceptable when the flour and water paste had been scraped off him, and then the steward brought in a ham. It was a ham that could only have come from a hog with a long-borne, crippling disease, the sort of ham that is reserved for officers who buy their own provisions, and only a man versed in morbid anatomy could have carved it handsomely. While Jack was struggling with his duties as a host, and adjuring the steward to clap on to its beak-head and to look alive, James turned to Stephen with a fellow guest's smile and said, "Is it not possible that I have already had the pleasure of being in your company, sir, in Dublin, or perhaps at Nice?" "I do not believe I've had the honour, sir. I'm often mistaken for my cousin of the same name. They tell me there is a striking resemblance, which makes me uneasy, I confess, for he's an ill-looking fellow, with a sly castle informer look on his face. And the character of an informer is more despised in our country than in any other, is it not? Rightly so, in my opinion, though indeed the creatures swarm there." This was in a conversational tone, loud enough to be heard by his neighbour over Jack's. "Easy now. Wish it may not be so infernally tough. Get a perches on his beam, Killick. Never mind thumbs." "I am entirely of your way of thinking," said James, with complete understanding in his look. "Will you take a glass of wine with me, sir?"
"With all my heart."
They pledged one another in the slow juice, vinegar, and sugar of lead that had been sold to Jack as wine, and then turned, the one with professional interest and the other with professional stoicism, to Jack's dismembered ham. The port was respectable, however, and after the cloth was drawn, there was an easier, far more comfortable atmosphere in the cabin. "Pray tell us about the action in the dart," said Jack, filling Dillon's glass. "I've heard so many different accounts of it." "Yes, pray do," said Stephen. "I should look upon it as a most particular favour." "Oh, it was not much of an affair," said James Dillon, "only with a contemptible set of privateers, a squabble among small craft. I had temporary command of a hired cutter, a one-masted fore-and-aft vessel, sir, of no great size." Stephen bowed. "Called the Dart. She had 8 4-pounders, which was very well, but I only had 13 men and a boy to fight them. However, orders came down to take a king's messenger and £10,000 in specie to Malta. And Captain Dockray asked me to give his wife and her sister a passage. I remember him as first of the Thunderer," said Jack. "A dear, good, kind man." "So he was," said James, shaking his head. "Well, we had a steady topsail abaccio, made our offing, tacked 3 or 4 leagues west of Agadi, and stood a little west of south. It Came on to blow after sundown, so having the ladies aboard and being short-handed in any case, I thought I should get under the lee of Pantelleria. It moderated in the night, and the sea went down, and there I was at 4:30 the next morning. I was shaving, as I remember very well, for I nicked my chin. "Ha!" said Stephen with satisfaction, when there was a cry of "Sail ho!" and I hurried up on deck. "I'm sure you did," said Jack, laughing. And there were three French lateen-rigged privateers. It was just light enough to make them out, hull up already, and presently I recognised the two nearest with my glass. They carried each a brass long 6-pounder and 4 1-pounder swivels in their bows, and we'd had a brush with them in the Euryalus when they had the heels of us, of course. "How many men in them?" "Oh, between 40 and 50 apiece, sir, and they each had maybe a dozen musketoons or patereros on their sides. And I made no doubt the third was just such another. They'd been haunting the Sicily Channel for some time, lying off Lampione and Lampedusa to refresh. Now they were under my lee, lying thus." He drew in wine on the table, "with the wind blowing from the decanter. They could outsail me close-hauled, and clearly their best plan was to engage me on either side and board." "Exactly," said Jack. "So, taking everything into consideration, my passengers, the King's messenger, the specie, and the Barbary coast ahead of me if I were to bear up, I thought the right thing to do was to attack them separately while I had the weather gauge and before the two nearest could join forces. The third was still 3 or 4 miles away, beating up under all sail. 8 of the cutter's crew were prime seamen, and Captain Dockray had sent his coxswain along with the ladies, a fine, strong fellow named William Brown. We soon cleared for action and treble-shotted the guns. And I must say the ladies behaved with great spirit, rather more than I could have wished. I represented to them that their place was below, in the hold, but Mrs. Dockray was not going to be told her duty by any young puppy without so much as an epaulette to his name, and did I think a post-captain's wife with 9 years' seniority was going to ruin her sprigged muslin in the bilges of my cockle-shell? She should tell my aunt, my cousin Ellis, the First Lord of the Admiralty, bring me to a court-martial for cowardice, for temerity, for not knowing my business. She understood discipline and subordination as well as the next woman, or better. And, come, my dear," says she to Miss Jones, "you ladle out the powder and fill the cartridges, and I will carry them up in my apron." By this time the position was so. He redrew the plan. The nearest privateer 2 cables' lengths away and to the lee of the other. Both of them had been firing for 10 minutes with their bow chasers. "How long is a cable?" asked Stephen. "About 200 yards, sir," said James. "So I put my helm down," she was wonderfully quick in stays, "and steered to ram the Frenchman amidships. With the wind on her quarter, the dart covered the distance in little more than a minute, which was as well, since they were peppering us hard. I steered myself until we were within pistol shot, and then ran forward to lead the boarders, leaving the tiller to the boy. Unhappily, he misunderstood me, and let the privateer shoot too far ahead, and we took her abaft her mizzen, our bowsprit carrying away her larboard mizzen shrouds, and a good deal of her poop rail and stern works. So, instead of boarding, we passed under her stern. Her mizzen went by the board with the shock, and we flew to the guns and poured in a raking broadside. There were just enough of us to fight 4 guns, with the King's messenger and me working one, and Brown helping us run it out when he'd fired his own. I luffed up to range along under a lee and get her cross her bows, so as to prevent her from manoeuvring. But with that great spread of canvas they have, you know, the dart was becalmed for a while, and we exchanged as hot a fire as quickly as we could keep it up. But at last we forged ahead, found our wind again, and tacked as quickly as we could right athwart the Frenchman's stem. Quicker, indeed, for we could only spare 2 hands to the sheet, and our boom came crack against her foreyard, carrying it away. the falling sail doused her bow chaser and the swivers. And as we came round, there was our starboard broadside ready, and we fired it so close that the wads set light to her foresail and the wreckage of the mizzen lying there all over her deck. Then they all called for quarter and struck. "Well done, well done," said Jack. "Oh, it was high time," said James, for the other privateer had been coming up fast. By something like a miracle, our bowsprit and boom were still standing. So I told the captain of the privateer that I should certainly sink him if he attempted to make sail, and bore up directly for his consort. I could not spare a single hand to take possession, nor the time. Of course not. So here we were, approaching on opposite tacks, and they were firing as the whim took them, everything they had. When we were 50 yards away, I paid off 4 points to bring the starboard guns to bear, gave her the broadside, then luffed up directly and gave her the other, from perhaps 20 yards. The second was very remarkable, sir. I didn't think 4-pounders could have done such execution. We fired on the down roll, a trifle later than I should have thought right, and all 4 shots struck her on the waterline at the height of her rise. I saw them go home, all on the same strake. A moment later, her people left their guns. They were running about and hallooing. Unhappily, Brown had stumbled as our gun recoiled, and the carriage had mangled his foot most cruelly. I bade him go below, but he would have none of it, would sit there and use a musket, and then he gave a cheer and said the Frenchman was sinking. And so he was. First they were awash, and then they went down, right down with their sails set. "My God!" cried Jack. So I stood straight on for the third, all hands knotting and splicing, for our rigging was cut to pieces. But the mast and boom were so wounded, a 6-pound ball clean through the mast and many deep scores, that I dared not carry a press of sail. So I'm afraid she ran clean away from us, and there was nothing for it but to beat back to the first privateer. Luckily, they'd been busy with their fire all this time, or they might have slipped off. We took 6 aboard to work our pumps, tossed their dead overboard, battened the rest down, took her in tow, set course for Malta, and arrived 2 days later, which surprised me, for our sails were a collection of holes held together with threads, and our hull not much better.
"Did you pick up the men from the one that sank?" asked Stephen.
"No, sir,"
said James.
"Not corsairs," said Jack. "Not with 13 men and a boy aboard. What were your losses, though?"
"Apart from Brown's foot and a few scratches, we had no one wounded, sir, nor a single man killed. It was an astonishing thing. But then we were pretty thin on the ground."
"And theirs?"
13 dead, sir. 29 prisoners."
"And the privateer you sank?"
56, sir."
"And the one that got away?"
"Well, 48, or so they told us, sir. But she hardly counts, since we had only a few random shots from her before she grew shy."
"Well, sir," said Jack, "I congratulate you with all my heart. It was a noble piece of work."
"So do I," said Stephen, "so do I. A glass of wine with you, Mr. Dillon," he said, bowing and raising his glass.
"Come," cried Jack, with a sudden inspiration, "let's drink to the renewed success of Irish arms and confusion to the Pope."
"The first part 10 times over," said Stephen, laughing. "But never a drop will I drink to the second, Voltairean though I may be. The poor gentleman has Boney on his hands, and that's confusion enough in all conscience. Besides, he's a very learned Benedictine."
"Then confusion to Boney."
"Confusion to Boney," they said, and drank their glasses dry.
"You will forgive me, sir, I hope," said Dillon. "I leave the deck in 30 minutes, and I should like to check the quarter bill first. I must thank you for a most enjoyable dinner."
"Lord, what a pretty action that was," said Jack when the door was closed. 146-14, or 15 if you count Mrs. Dockray. It's just the kind of thing Nelson might have done. Prompt, straight at 'em."
"You know Lord Nelson, sir?"
I had the honour of serving under him at the Nile, said Jack, and of dining in his company twice. His face broke into a smile at the recollection.
May I beg you to tell me what kind of a man he is?
Oh, you'd take to him directly, I'm sure. He's very slight, frail. I could pick him up, I mean no disrespect, with one hand. But you know he's a very great man directly. There's something in philosophy called an electrical particle, is there not? A charged atom, if you follow me. He spoke to me on each occasion. The first time it was to say, may I trouble you for the salt, sir. I've always said it as close as I can to his way ever since. You may have noticed it. But the second time I was trying to make my neighbour, a soldier, understand our naval tactics, weather gauge, breaking the line and so on, and in a pause he leant over with such a smile and said, never mind manoeuvres, always go at them. I shall never forget it. Never mind manoeuvres, always go at them. And at that same dinner, he was telling us all how someone had offered him a boat cloak on a cold night, and he'd said no, he was quite warm. His zeal for his king and country kept him warm. It sounds absurd as I tell it, doesn't it? And was it another man, any other man, you would cry out, oh, what pitiful stuff, and dismiss it as mere enthusiasm, but with him, you feel your bosom glow and... Now what in the devil's name is it, Mr. Richards? Come in or out, there's a good fellow. Don't stand in the door like a goddamn Lenten cock.
Sir, said the poor clerk, you said I might bring you the remaining papers before tea, and your tea is just coming up.
Well, well, so I did, said Jack. God, what an infernal heap.
Leave them here, Mr. Richards. I'll see to them before we reach Cagliari.
The top ones are those which Captain Allen left to be written fair. They only need to be signed, sir, said the clerk, backing out. Jack glanced at the top of the pile, paused, and then cried, there! There you are, just so. There's the service for you from clue to earring, the Royal Navy stock and fluke. You get into a fine flow of patriotic fervour, you're ready to plunge into the thick of battle, and you're asked to sign this sort of thing. He passed Stephen the carefully written sheet. His Majesty's sloop Sophie at sea. My lord, I am to beg you will be pleased to order a court-martial to be held on Isaac Wilson, seaman, belonging to the sloop I have the honour to command, for having committed the unnatural crime of sodomy on a goat in the goat house on the evening of March the 16th. I have the honour to remain, my lord, your lordship's most obedient, very humble servant, the Right Honourable Lord Keith, K.B., etc., etc., Admiral of the Blue.
It's odd how the law always harps upon the unnaturalness of sodomy, observed Stephen, though I know at least two judges who are pederasts, and, of course, barristers. What will happen to him?
Oh, he'll be hanged. Run up at the yardarm and boats attending from every ship in the fleet.
That seems a little extreme.
Of course it is. Oh, what an infernal bore. Witnesses going over to the flagship by the dozen, days lost. The Sophia laughing stock. Why will they report these things? The goat must be slaughtered. That's but fair. Then it shall be served out to the mess that informed on him.
Could you not set them both ashore?
On separate shores, if you have strong feelings on the moral issue, and sail quietly away. Well, said Jack, whose anger had died down, perhaps there is something in what you propose. A dish of tea, you take milk, sir?
Goat's milk, sir?
Well, I suppose it is.
Perhaps without milk, then, if you please.
You told me, I believe, that the gunner was ailing. Would this be a convenient time for seeing what I can do for him? Pray, which is the gun-room? You'd expect to find him there, wouldn't you? But, in fact, his cabin's elsewhere nowadays. Killick'll show you. The gun-room in a sloop is where the officers mess.
In the gunroom itself, the master stretched and said to the purser, "Plenty of elbow room now, Mr. Ricketts." "Very true, Mr. Marshall," said the purser. "We see great changes these days, and how they'll work out I do not know."
"Oh, I think they may answer well enough," said Mr. Marshall, slowly picking the crumbs off his waistcoat. "All these capers," went on the purser, in a low, dubious voice. "The main yard, the guns, the drafts he pretended to know nothing about. All these new hands there's not room for. The people at watch and watch. Charlie tells me there's a great deal of murmuring." He jerked his head towards the men's quarters.
"I dare say there is, I dare say there is. All the old ways changed and all the old messes broken up. And I dare say we may be a little flighty too, so young and fine with our brand new epaulette. But if the steady old standing officers back him up, why, then I think it may answer well enough. The carpenter likes him. So does Watt, for he's a good seaman, and that's certain. And Mr. Dillon seems to know his profession too.
Maybe."
"Maybe," said the purser, who knew the master's enthusiasms of old. "And then again," went on Mr. Marshall, "things may be a little more lively under the new proprietor. The men will like that when they grow used to it, and so will the officers, I'm sure. All that is wanted is for the standing officers to back him up, and it'll be plain sailing."
"What?" said the purser, cupping his ear, for Mr. Dillon was having the guns moved, and amid the general rumbling thunder that accompanied this operation, an occasional louder bang obliterated speech. Incidentally, it was this all-pervasive thunder that made their conversation possible, for in general there could be no such thing as private talk in a vessel 26 yards long inhabited by 91 men, whose gun-room had even smaller apartments opening off it, screened by very thin wood, and indeed sometimes by no more than canvas. "Plain sailing. I say, if the officers back him up, it will all be plain sailing."
"Maybe."
"But if they do not," went on Mr. Ricketts, "if they do not, and if he persists in capers of this kind, which I believe it is his nature so to do, why then I dare say he will exchange out of the old Sophie as quick as Mr. Harvey did, for a brig is not a frigate, far less a ship of the line. You're right on top of your people, and they can give you hell or cause you to be broke as easy as kiss my hand."
"You don't have to tell me a brig is not a frigate, nor yet a ship of the line, Mr. Ricketts," said the master.
"Maybe I don't have to tell you a brig is not a frigate nor yet a ship of the line, Mr. Marshall," said the purser warmly. "But when you've been at sea as long as I have, Mr. Marshall, you will know there is a great deal more than mere seamanship required of a captain. Any damn tarpaulin can manage a ship in a storm," he went on in a slighting voice, "and any housewife in breeches can keep the decks clean and the falls just so. But it needs a headpiece," tapping his own, "and true bottom and steadiness, as well as conduct, to be the captain of a man-of-war. And these are qualities not to be found in every Johnny-come-lately, nor in every Jack-lie-by-the-wall neither," he added, more or less to himself. "I don't know, I'm sure." Chapter 4. The drum rolled and thundered at the Sophie's hatchway. Feet came racing up from below, a desperate rushing sound that made even the tense drumbeat seem more urgent. But apart from the landmen's in the new draft, the men's faces were calm, for this was beating to quarters, an afternoon ritual that many of the crew had performed some 2,000 or 3,000 times, each running to a particular place by one allotted gun or to a given set of ropes that he knew by heart. No one could have called this a creditable performance, however. Much had been changed in the Sophie's comfortable old routine,
The manning of the guns was different. A score of worried, sheep-like landmen had to be pushed and pulled into something like the right place. And since most of the newcomers could not yet be allowed to do anything more than heave under guidance, the sloop's waist was so crowded that men trampled upon one another's toes. 10 minutes passed while the Sophie's people seethed about her upper deck and her fighting tops. Jack stood watching placidly abaft the wheel, while Dylan barked orders, and the warrant officers and midshipmen darted furiously about, aware of their captain's gaze, and conscious that their anxiety was not improving anything at all. Jack had expected something of a shambles, though not anything quite so unholy as this, but his native good humour and the delight of feeling even the inept stirring of this machine under his control overcame all other, more righteous emotions. "Why do they do this?" asked Stephen at his elbow. "Why do they run about so earnestly?" "The idea is that every man shall know exactly where to go in action, in an emergency," said Jack. "It would never do if they had to stand pondering. The gun teams are there at their stations already, you see, and so are Sergeant Quinn's marines here. The forecastle men are all there, as far as I can make out, and I dare say the waisters will be in order presently. A captain to each gun, do you see, and a sponger and boarder next to him, the man with the belt and cutlass. They join the boarding party, and a sail trimmer, who leaves the gun if we have to brace the yards round, for example, in action, and a fireman, the one with the bucket. His task is to dash out any fire that may start. Now, there's Pullings, reporting his division ready to Dylan. We shall not be long now." There were plenty of people on the little quarter-deck. The master at the con, the quartermaster at the wheel, the marine sergeant and his small-arms party, the signal midshipman, part of the after-guard, the gun crews, James Dillon, the clerk, and still others. But Jack and Stephen paced up and down as though they were alone. Jack enveloped in the Olympian majesty of a captain, and Stephen caught up within his aura. It was natural enough to Jack, who had known this state of affairs since he was a child, but it was the first time that Stephen had met with it, and it gave him a not altogether disagreeable sensation of waking death. Either the absorbed, attentive men on the other side of the glass wall were dead, mere phantasmata, or he was, though in that case it was a strange little death, for although he was used to this sense of isolation, of being a colourless shade in a silent private underworld, he now had a companion, an audible companion. Your station, for example, would be below, in what we call the cockpit. Not that it is a real cockpit, any more than that forecastle's a real forecastle in the sense of being raised, but we call it the cockpit, with the midshipman's sea chests as your operating table and your instruments all ready. Is that where I should live? No, no, we shall fix you up with something better than that, even when you come under the Articles of War, said Jack with a smile. You'll find that we still honour learning, at least to the extent of 10 square feet of privacy and as much fresh air on the quarter-deck as you may choose to breathe in. Stephen nodded. Tell me, he said in a low voice, some moments later. Were I under naval discipline, could that fellow have me whipped? He nodded towards Mr. Marshall. The master? Cried Jack with inexpressible amazement. Yes, said Stephen, looking attentively at him with his head slightly inclined to the left. But he's the master, said Jack. If Stephen had called the Sophie's stem her stern, or her truck her keel, he would have understood the situation directly. But that Stephen should confuse the chain of command, the relative status of a captain and a master, of a commissioned officer and a warrant officer, so subverted the natural order, so undermined the sempiternal universe, that for a moment his mind could hardly encompass it. Yet Jack, though no great scholar, no judge of a hexameter, was tolerably quick, and after gasping no more than twice, he said,
"My dear sir, I believe you've been led astray by the words master and master and commander. Illogical terms, I must confess. The first is subordinate to the second. You must allow me to explain our naval ranks sometime, but in any case you will never be flogged. No, no, you shall not be flogged," he added, gazing with pure affection, and with something like awe at so magnificent a prodigy, at an ignorance so very far beyond anything that even his wide-ranging mind had yet conceived. James Dillon broke through the glass wall. "Hands at quarter, sir, if you please," he said, raising his three-corner hat. "Very well, Mr. Dillon," said Jack. "We will exercise the great guns." A four-pounder may not throw a very great weight of metal, and it may not be able to pierce 2 feet of oak half a mile away, as a 32-pounder can, but it does throw a solid 3-inch cast-iron ball at 1,000 feet a second, which is an ugly thing to receive. And the gun itself is a formidable machine. Its barrel is 6 feet long, it weighs 1,200 weight, it stands on a ponderous oak carriage, and when it is fired, it leaps back as though it were violently alive. The Sophie possessed 14 of these, 7 aside, and the 2 aftermost guns on the quarterdeck were gleaming brass. Each gun had a crew of 4, and a man or boy to bring up powder from the magazine. Each group of guns was in charge of a midshipman or a master's mate. Pullings had the 6 forward guns, Ricketts the 4 in the waist, and Babington the 4 farthest aft. "Mr. Babington, where is this gun's powder horn?" asked Jack coldly. "I don't know, sir," stammered Babington, very red. "It seems to have gone astray."
"Quarter gunner," said Jack, "go to Mr. Day, no, to his mate, for he's sick, and get another."
His inspection showed no other obvious shortcomings, but when he had had both broadsides run in and out 6 times, that is to say when the men had been through all the motions short of actually firing the guns, his face grew long and grave. They were quite extraordinarily slow. They had obviously been trained to fire nothing but whole broadsides at once. Very little independent firing. They seemed quite happy with easing their guns gently up to the port at the rate of the slowest of them all, and the whole exercise had an artificial wooden air. It was true that ordinary convoy duty in a sloop didn't give the men any very passionate conviction of the gun's vital reality, but even so, "how I wish I could afford a few barrels of powder," he thought, with a clear image of the gunner's accounts in his mind. 49 half-barrels in all, 7 under the Sophie's full allowance, 41 of them red, large grain, 7 of them white, large grain, restored powder of doubtful strength, and 1 barrel of fine grain for priming. The barrels held 45 pounds. So the Sophie would nearly empty one with each double broadside. "But even so," he went on, "I think we can have a couple of rounds. God knows how long these charges have been lying in the guns. Besides," he added in a voice within his inner voice, a voice from a far deeper level, "think of the lovely smell." "Very well," he said aloud. "Mr. Mowat, be so good as to go into my cabin. Sit down by the table watch and take exact note of the time that elapses between the first and second discharge of each gun. Mr. Pullings, we'll start with your division. Number 1. Silence, 4 and aft." Dead silence fell over the Sophie. The wind sang evenly in her taut weather rigging, steady at 2 points abaft the beam. Number 1's crew licked their lips nervously. Their gun was in its ordinary position of rest, bowsed up tight against its port and lashed there, put away, as it were. "Cast loose your gun." They cast loose the tackles that held the gun hard against the side,
and cut the spun-yarn frapping that clenched the breeching to hold it firmer still. With a gentle squeal of trucks, the gun showed that it was free. A man held each side tackle, or the Sophie's heel, which made the rear tackle unnecessary, would have brought the gun inboard before the next word of command. "Level your gun!" The sponger pushed his handspike under the thick breech of the gun, and with a quick heave levered it up, while number one's captain thrust the wooden wedge more than halfway under, bringing the barrel to the horizontal point-blank position. "Out, Trompion!" They let the gun run in fast. The breeching checked its inward course when the muzzle was a foot or so inboard. The sail trimmer whipped out the carved and painted Trompion that plugged it. "Run out your gun!" Clapping onto the side tackles, they heaved her up hand over hand, running the carriage hard against the side and coiling the falls, coiling them down in wonderfully neat little fakes. "Prime!" The captain took his priming iron, thrust it down the touch hole, and pierced the flannel cartridge lying within the gun, poured fine powder from his horn into the open vent and onto the pan, bruising it industriously with the nozzle. The sponger put the flat of his hand over the powder to prevent its blowing away, and the fireman slung the horn behind his back. "Point your gun!" And to this order Jack added, "As she lies," since he wished to add no complications of traversing or elevating for range at this stage. Two of the gun's crew were now holding the side tackles. The sponger knelt on one side with his head away from the gun, blowing gently on the smouldering slow match he had taken from its little tub, for the Sophie didn't run to flint logs. The powder boy stood with the next cartridge in its leather box over on the starboard side directly behind the gun. The captain, holding his vent bit and sheltering the priming, bent over the gun, staring along its barrel. "Fire!" The slow match whipped across. The captain stubbed it hard down onto the priming. For an infinitesimal spark of time, there was a hissing, a flash, and then the gun went off with the round, satisfying bang of a pound and more of hard-rammed powder exploding in a confined space. A stab of crimson flame in the smoke, flying morsels of wad, the gun shooting 8 feet backwards under the arched body of its captain and between the members of its crew, the deep twang of the breeching as it brought up the recoil, all these were virtually inseparable in time. And before they were over, the next order came. "Stop your vent!" cried Jack, watching for the flight of the ball, as the white smoke raced streaming down to leeward. The captain stabbed his vent piece into the touch hole, and the ball sent up a fleeting plume in the choppy sea 400 yards to windward, then another and another, ducks and drakes for 50 yards before it sank. The crew clapped onto the rear tackle to hold the gun firmly inboard against the roll. "Sponge your gun!" The sponger darted his sheepskin swab into the fireman's bucket, and pushing his face into the narrow space between the muzzle and the side, he shot the handle out of the port and thrust the swab down the bore of the gun. He twirled it conscientiously and brought it out, blackened, with a little smoking rag on it. "Load with cartridge!" The powder boy had the tight cloth bag there ready. The sponger entered it and rammed it hard down. The captain, with his priming iron in the vent to feel for its arrival, cried, "Home! Shot your gun!" The ball was there to hand in its garland, and the wad in its cheese. But an unlucky slip sent the ball trundling across the deck towards the forehatch, with the anxious captain, sponger and powder boy following its erratic course. Eventually, it joined the cartridge, with the wad rammed down over it, and Jack cried, "Run out your gun! Prime! Point your gun! Fire! Mr. Mowat!" he called through the cabin skylight. "What was the interval?"
3 minutes and 3/4, sir."
Oh, dear," said Jack, almost to himself. There were no words in the vocabulary at his command to express his distress. Pulling's division looked apprehensive and ashamed. Number three gun crew had stripped to the waist and had tied their handkerchiefs round their heads against the flash and the thunder. They were spitting on their hands, and Mr. Pullings himself was fussing anxiously about with the crows, handspikes and swabs. "Silence! Cast loose your gun! Level your gun! Out, Tompion! Run out your gun!" This time it was rather better. Just over 3 minutes. But then they'd not dropped their shot, and Mr. Pullings had helped run up the gun and haul on the rear tackle, gazing absently into the sky as he did so, to prove that he was not in fact there at all. As the firing came aft, gun by gun, so Jack's melancholy increased. One and three had not been unlucky bands of boobies. This was the Sophie's true average rate of fire. Archaic. Antediluvian. And if there had been any question of aiming, of traversing the guns, heaving them round with crows and handspikes, it would have been even slower. Number five wouldn't fire, damp having got at the powder, and the gun had to be wormed and drawn. That could happen in any ship, but it was a pity that it also occurred twice in the starboard broadside. The Sophie had come up into the wind to fire her starboard guns, out of a certain delicacy about shooting at random into her convoy, and she was lying there, pitching easily, with almost no way on her, while the last damp charge was being extracted, when Stephen, feeling that in this lull he might without impropriety address the captain, said to Jack, "Pray tell me why those ships are so very close together. Are they conversing, rendering one another mutual assistance?" He pointed over the neat wall of hammocks in the quarter-netting. Jack followed his finger and gazed for an unbelieving second at the rearmost vessel in his convoy, the daughter Engelbrektsdatter, the Norwegian Cat. "Hands to the braces," he shouted. "Port your helm flutted for a jump to it. Brail up the mainsail." Slowly, then faster and faster, with all the wind in her sharp-braced headsails, the Sophie paid off. Now the wind was on her port beam. A few moments later she was right before it, and in still another moment she steadied on her course with the wind 3 points on her starboard quarter. There had been a good deal of trampling to and fro, with Mr. Watt and his mates roaring and piping like fury, but the Sophies were better hands with a sail than a gun, and quite soon Jack could cry, "Square mainsails! Topmast stunsails! Mr. Watt, the top chains and puddening. But I needn't tell you what to do, I see." "Aye, aye, sir," said the boatswain, clanking away aloft, already loaded with the chains that were to prevent the yards falling in action. "Mowat, run up with a glass and tell me what you see. Mr. Dillon, you'll not forget that lookout. We'll have the hide of him tomorrow if he lives to see it. Mr. Lamb, you have your shot plugs ready?" "Ready, aye, ready, sir," said the carpenter, smiling, for this was not a serious question. "Deck!" hailed Mowat, high above the taut, straining canvas. "Deck! She's an Algerine. A quarter galley. They've boarded the Cat. They haven't carried her yet. I think the Norwegians are holding out in their close quarters." "Anything to windward!" called Jack. In the pause that followed, the peevish crackling of pistols could be heard from the Norwegian, struggling faintly up through the streaming of the wind. "Yes, sir, a sail, a lateen, hull down in the wind's eye. I can't make her out for sure. Standing east, standing due east, I think." Jack nodded, looking up and down his two broadsides. He was a big man at any time, but now he seemed to be at least twice his usual size. His eyes were shining in an extraordinary manner, as blue as the sea, and a continuous smile showed a gleam across the lively scarlet of his face. Something of the same change had come over the Sophie, with her big new square mainsail and her topsails immensely broadened by the studding sails at either side of them. She, like her master and commander, seemed to have doubled in size as she tore heavily through the sea. "Well, Mr. Dillon," he cried, "this is a bit of luck, is it not?" Stephen, looking at them curiously,
saw that the same extraordinary animation had seized upon James Dillon. Indeed, the whole crew was filled with a strange ebullience. Close by him, the marines were checking the flints of their muskets, and one of them was polishing the buckle of his cross-belt, breathing on it and laughing happily between the carefully directed breaths. "Yes, sir," said James Dillon. "It couldn't have fallen more happily." "Signal the convoy to haul 2 points to larboard and to reduce sail. Mr. Richards, have you noted the time? You must carefully note the time of everything." "But, Dillon, what can the fellow be thinking of? Did he suppose we were engaged? Blind? However, this is not time to... We'll board, of course, if only the Norwegians can hold out long enough. I hate firing into a galley in any event. I believe you may have all our pistols and cutlasses served out. Now, Mr. Marshall," he said, turning to the master, who was at his action station by the wheel, and who was now responsible for sailing the Sophie, "I want you to lay us alongside that damned moor. You may set the lower stunsails if she'll bear them." At this moment the gunner crept up the ladder. "Well, Mr. Day," said Jack, "I'm happy to see you on deck. Are you a little better?" "Much better, sir, I thank you," said Mr. Day, "thanks to the gentleman," nodding towards Stephen. "It worked," he said, directing his voice towards the taffrail. "I just thought I'd report as I was in my place, sir." "Glad of it. I'm very glad of it. This is a bit of luck, Master Gunner, I believe," said Jack. "Why, so it is, sir. It worked, Doctor. It worked, sir, like a maiden's dream." "So it is," said the gunner, looking complacently over the mile or so of sea at the Daughter Engelbrechtstatter and the Corsair, at the Sophie, with all her guns warm, freshly loaded, run out, perfectly ready, her crew on tiptoe, and her decks cleared for action. "Here we were exercising," went on Jack, almost to himself, "and that impudent dog rode upwind on the far side and made a snatch at the cat. What can he be thinking of? And would be running off with her now if our good doctor hadn't brought us to our senses." "Never was such a doctor in my belief," said the gunner. "Now, I fancy I'd best get down into my magazine, sir. We've not all that powder filled, and I dare say you'll be calling for a tidy parcel." "Ha, ha, ha!" "My dear sir," said Jack to Stephen, measuring the Sophie's increasing speed and the distance that separated her from the embattled cat. In this state of triply intensified vitality, he could perfectly well calculate, talk to Stephen, and revolve a thousand shifting variables all at once. "My dear sir, do you choose to go below, or should you rather stay on deck? Perhaps it would divert you to go into the main top with a musket, along with the sharpshooters, and have a bang at the villains." "No, no, no," said Stephen. "I deprecate violence. My part is to heal rather than to kill. Or at least to kill with kindly intent. Pray let me take my place, my station in the cockpit." "I hoped you'd say that," said Jack, shaking him by the hand. "I hadn't liked to suggest it to my guest, however. It'll comfort the men amazingly, all of us indeed. Mr. Ricketts, show Dr. Matcher in the cockpit, and give the loblolly boy a hand with the chests." A sloop, with the depth of a mere 10 feet 10 inches, cannot rival a ship of the line for dank, airless obscurity below, but the Sophie did astonishingly well, and Stephen was obliged to call for another lantern to check and lay out his instruments and the meagre store of bandages, lint, tourniquets and pledgets. He was sitting there with Northcote's marine practice held close to the light, carefully reading, "Having divided the skin, order the same assistant to draw it up as much as possible, then cut through the flesh and bones circularly," when Jack came down. He had put on Hessian boots and his sword, and he was carrying a pair of pistols. "May I use the room next door?" asked Stephen, adding in Latin so that he might not be understood by the loblolly boy, "It might discourage the patients were they to see me consulting my printed authorities." "Certainly, certainly," cried Jack, riding straight over the Latin. "Anything you like. I'll leave these with you. We shall board, if ever we can come up with them, and then, you know, they might try to board us. There's no telling. "These damned Algerines are usually crammed with men. Cutthroat dogs, every one of them," he added, laughing heartily and vanishing into the gloom. Jack had only been below a very short while, but by the time he returned to the quarter-deck, the situation had entirely changed. The Algerines were in command of the Cat. She was falling off before the northerly wind. They were setting her cross jack, and it was clear that they hoped to get away with her. The galley lay in its own length away from her, on her starboard quarter. It lay there motionless on its oars, 14 great sweeps aside, headed directly towards the Sophie, with its huge lateen sails brailed up loosely to the yards. A long, low, slim vessel. Longer than the Sophie, but much slighter and narrower. Obviously very fast, and obviously in enterprising hands. It had a singularly lethal, reptilian air. Its intention was clearly either to engage the Sophie, or at least to delay her until the prize crew should have run the Cat a mile or so down the wind towards the safety of the coming night. The distance was now a little over a quarter of a mile, and with a smooth, continuous flow, the relative positions were perpetually changing. The Cat's speed was increasing, and in 4 or 5 minutes she was a cable's length to the leeward of the galley, which still lay there on its oars. A fleeting cloud of smoke appeared in the galley's bows. A ball hummed overhead at about the level of the topmast cross-trees, followed in half a heartbeat by the deep boom of the gun that had fired it. "Note down the time, Mr. Richards," said Jack to the pale clerk. The nature of his pallor had changed, and his eyes were starting from his head. Jack hurried forward, just in time to see the flash of the galley's second gun. With an enormous smithy noise, the ball struck the fluke of the Sophie's best bower anchor, bent it half over, and glanced off into the sea far behind. "An 18-pounder," observed Jack to the boatswain, standing there at his post on the forecastle. "Maybe even a 24. Oh, for my long 12s," he added inwardly. The galley had no broadside, naturally, but mounted her guns fore and aft. In his glass, Jack could see that the forward battery consisted of 2 heavy guns, a smaller one and some swivels. And, of course, the Sophie would be exposed to their raking fire throughout her approach. The swivels were firing now. A high, sharp, cracking noise. Jack returned to the quarterdeck. "Silence, fore and aft!" he cried through the low, excited murmur. "Silence! Cast loose your guns! Level your guns! Out, Tompions! Run out your guns! Mr. Dillon, they are to be trained as far forward as possible. Mr. Babington, tell the gunner the next round will be chain." An 18-pound ball hit the Sophie's side between the larboard number 1 and 3 guns, sending in a shower of sharp-edged splintered wood, some pieces 2 feet long and heavy. It continued its course along the crowded deck, knocked down a marine, and struck against the mainmast, its force almost spent. A dismal "oh, oh, oh" showed that some of the splinters had done their work, and a moment later 2 seamen hurried by, carrying their mate below, leaving a trail of blood as they went. "Are those guns trained round?" cried Jack. "All hard round, sir," came the reply after a gasping pause. "Starboard broadside first. Fire as they bear. Fire high. Fire for the masts. Right, Mr. Marshall, over she goes." The Sophie yawed 45 degrees off her course, presenting quarter of her starboard side to the galley, which instantly sent another 18-pound ball into it amidships, just above the waterline. Its deep, resonant impact surprising Stephen Maturin as he put a ligature round William Musgrave's spouting femoral artery, almost making him miss the loop. But now the Sophie's guns were bearing, and the starboard broadside went off on 2 successive rolls. The sea beyond the galley spat up in white plumes, and the Sophie's deck swirled with smoke, acrid, piercing gunpowder smoke. As the 7th gun fired, Jack cried, "Over again!"
and the Sophie's head came round for the larboard broadside. The eddying cloud cleared under her lee. Jack saw the galley fire its whole forward battery and leap into motion under the power of its oars to avoid the Sophie's fire. The galley fired high, on the up